This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease. And the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Hello and welcome back to Outward. I'm Brian Lauder. I edit Outward here at Slate. And no, I'm not crying at the Tales of the City Netflix trailer. You are.
I'm Christina Cotarucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of The Waves, Slate's podcast about women and gender. And I am out here representing the femmes whose eyeliner hangs on by sheer force of will all through this fucking allergy season. I swear my eyebrows are itching right now. God. It's so bad.
Work. And I'm Brandon Tinsley, the associate editor at New America and a contributing writer at Pacific Standard Magazine. And I'm just happy that we are finally back to rosé season.
You would be.
Brandon, would you say that rosé is part of a certain gay summer scene?
100%. Carly Rae and rosé all day.
That is fascinating.
Do you have a tank top that says that on it? I'll be surprised if you don't.
I should wear one to our live show this summer.
Yeah, you should.
Well, it's fascinating that you would say that because it just so happens that our show this month is all about the scene in queer life. Now, we've all met those queers who aren't into the scene or define themselves as non-scene, and what exactly they're talking about is going to be part of our discussion today. But we're also going to look at the scene in other ways. How many are there, and how do they inform our identities as queer people? Do we expect our political figures and leaders to be a part of one? That's right. We're going to talk about Pete Buttigieg.
Dun, and dun, we'll find, dun.
And we'll also find out why it can be a struggle for bi folks to find a scene of their own. All that, plus we've got our regular PNPs and updates to the gay agenda. Now, before we jump in, a quick editor's note. If all this talk of the scene has you thirsty for more, head over to Outward on Slate.com, our internet website magazine, for a package of articles looking at the topic from a bunch of fascinating angles, including leather dykes, gay bros, geeks, and a thriving queer and trans scene in Puerto Rico. You scene queens can read the whole package at slate.com/tag/scene.
And now we're going to kick things off with our April Pride and Provocations. Happy to start. And in a twist, I'm provoked, guys. I'm provoked.
God. You say that with such a big smile on your face, though, so make us
it. It might just be me being grumpy. So the sequel to Love, Simon, which for anyone who doesn't know, is Greg Berlanti's 2018 coming-of-age rom-com slash adaptation of the YA novel with a great title, Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda, is reportedly getting turned into a TV series, which I think is great for a bazillion reasons. I'll list a couple. So it was the first film of its kind to be backed by a major studio. It underscores the importance of queer people telling their own stories. And it also made a lot of queer people, including queer people on the set of the show, of the movie, revisit their own coming out stories in really beautiful and touching ways. And yet, a lot of people on gay Twitter have been in their feelings about it in a way that I thought was immediately exhausting. So on the one hand, I get where some of the criticism is coming from. A lot of people are saying sort of like, we want stories that move beyond cute white boys, even if said cute white boys are gay. Very valid criticism and critique to lodge. But on the other hand, if the reports are true, the TV series would adapt the sequel, which doesn't focus as much on Simon, but more so on his friend Leah, who is bi. And that's straight up a slice of queer life that the culture at large glosses over and dismisses all the time, which I think is something we should actually be holding up and celebrating. In addition, I think that we should want it all. I think we should want stories that portray aspects of queer life that are still really difficult for a lot of queer folks to deal with, as Love, Simon does, as Call Me By Your Name does, because I have to plug that as well. and we should want stories that expand those narratives, as Pose does, as Moonlight does. So I think we deserve and should want all of this shit. So I'm off my soapbox.
No, that was a really good soapbox. And I actually wasn't even aware of this conversation that was going on. So
it might be my like Twitter bubble. Who knows?
Okay. Love that bubble. Want to be part of that bubble. Brian, what about you?
Well, you guys, I went to the Black Party recently. I don't know if all of our listeners will know what that is.
I definitely didn't.
Yeah, same.
Well, I'm happy to share. There's also a piece on Slate.com, the internet magazine. The headline is Black Party 1989, that talks about the history of it, and specifically like covers what it looked like in 1989 at the height of the AIDS crisis. But it's a party that's gone on for about 40 or exactly 40 years now. And it's, you could call it like part of the circuit party scene, although it's kind of like anti-circuit in certain ways. It's a kink fetish sort of vibe. And it always takes place in like this, in a huge venue, and the tickets are kind of expensive, and it's, but it, it attracts like 4,000 people. People travel from over the world. So it's this big gay male cultural event, that I've always been curious about. And so finally decided to go this year. And it made me so proud, you guys. It was like amazing to see this institution like happen. All the effort that goes into it is pretty incredible. There's a diversity of age and body type there that you don't see in a lot of gay male spaces. Mm-hmm. I'd actually say that a huge percentage of the attendees were probably like over 40.
Wow.
Much older than that even in many cases. And so that was really cool to see. And you know, the other thing that made me proud, and I was not proud of myself for, is that the party goes for, I think it's like 13 hours, maybe more than that.
Wow.
It's from like 10 to 5 the next afternoon. I made it like 8 hours.
Could not
do anymore. But like, I know people that really did make it the whole time, and they are inspirations. So proud of the Black Party, proud it exists, and hope it continues for another 40 years.
I'm still proud of you at age, you know, 30, whatever. 31? How old are you?
One, yeah.
I'm
yeah.
still proud of you for making it 8 hours into a party.
I barely did.
Yeah. I also have a pride this month. I am proud of the people putting together the DC Dyke March this year. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, the Dyke March as a concept and as an institution started in DC. DC was home to the first Dyke March ever in 1993. So, you know, 26 years ago at this point, it was actually held in April, and Dyke identified people came from all over the place. 20,000 or more people, I think were reports at the time, came. They marched from DuPont Circle, DC's sort of historic neighborhood, down to the White House and the National Mall. It was a protest, as Dyke marches still are today, in a way that pride parades aren't as much. And since then, you know, places all around the country and all around the world have instated Dyke marches as part of their pride celebrations, or in opposition to some of their pride celebrations, usually the day before the pride parade in whatever city. But DC's has been out of commission for, 12 years. So I was sort of barely in D.C. when the Dyke March stopped happening. So I've never been to one in mm-hmm. my own city. And a couple of years ago when I was working at the Washington City Paper, I reported on a group of women who were trying to make it happen again. It fizzled out for a number of reasons that I won't get into here. But there's a bunch of people who are making it happen this year, and they're, in true Dyke fashion, taking an extremely intentional approach. There's been a million meetings. I had breakfast with one of the organizers a couple days ago, and we talked about it, and she's just working so hard on it. And most of the people she's working with aren't even her friends. They're just people from the community who've stepped up because they want to see it happen. The theme is Dykes Against Displacement. They're going to be partnering with some anti-gentrification organizations. I think it's going to be fucking awesome. I'm really excited. They're taking part of the route of the original Dyke March, even though it makes a little bit less sense now to do it around the National Mall in the White House when it's really just like tourists in their MAGA t-shirts and whatever. But, you know, that's also part of like the provocative element that I think is really integral to the Dyke March. But also I think they want to make it very focused on local community, which is really appeals to me. I'm so excited. And after the Dyke March, I will bring my report back to this podcast.
I love that. Yeah. So thank you to everyone who rated and reviewed our show. It's so great to see our listeners in the comments and know that it helps to get us into more ears where we can continue to advance the gay agenda. So please keep it up. Also, a quick plug to our listeners in New York or our listeners willing to travel for a bit of queer fun. You can get a double shot of Outward this summer. First, join us along with the Waves on June 8th for a live brunch show on the High Line. And then we're back in New York on June 27th for a live show at Joe's Pub, where we'll be commemorating 50 years since Stonewall and celebrating Pride. You can get your tickets now at slate.com/live, and we hope to see you there.
Yes, please come.
It'll be so fun.
The new Starz series, Marianne George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Marianne George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
All right. Today's theme, the scene, is something that we've been wanting to tackle for a while. So in almost every queer community of a certain size, there are plenty of people who are into the scene and proud of it. And plenty of queer people or gay people who take equal pride in rejecting that scene. You might almost say that's a scene in and of itself. Sometimes it's because these people identify more with straight culture. They don't feel authentically connected to the sort of tropes and expectations of what it means to be gay in certain spaces. Sometimes people will reject the scene for other reasons. It's too homogenous. It's too conservative. It's too insular. It's too alcohol-centric. But also, as we know, queers are not a monolith, so there are scenes within scenes or other sub-scenes, queer scenes that have established themselves as alternatives or add-ons to larger gay and queer scenes, and that landscape of scenes has changed over time. So we're delighted to include a member of a different generation, our fairy godzaddy, June Thomas. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, children.
Did you like that very flattering introduction?
Yeah, no, never felt younger.
So first question for you three. Do you consider yourselves part of the gay scene registered trademark? And what about, you know, subcultures, smaller scenes, more specific scenes? Are you part of them?
I will go first. I think that, I am older. I am, let's just say in my 50s. And I remember when I was a mere youth, only being aware of like one scene, and that was like the bars, or maybe if there was a place where there was dancing, and that just felt like that was the scene. And then over time, I realized that there were many others, and I was part of other scenes that, you know, if I worked at a feminist bookstore, that was actually a scene. I was on a magazine collective, and that was a scene. And all the time that I was thinking, oh, I'm not part of that group, which in my case was like Sporty Dykes or, to a certain sense, Bar Dykes. I mean, I would go to a bar once every week or once every couple of weeks, but I knew that wasn't my scene because, well, honestly, I wasn't cute enough, or I just kind of wasn't like...
Don't believe it.
But I think people do believe that. Like, whether or not it's true, because we're all cute, there is a feeling, I think, that, like, you go to a bar, especially when you're relatively freshly out or you're new to a town and you're trying to figure it out, and you are so self-conscious. And I think that there are, in my case, there were women who were just so, like, I don't honestly know how much time they spent on their appearance, but to me, they were perfection, you know, their clothes, their hair, their, you know, their self-presentation. And I just felt, whether or not it was true, that mine just was never going to match up. I can't even remember. I just remember thinking, oh my God, I will never be that, like, smooth or something. I don't even quite know what the adjective is, but I knew that I didn't feel I was that. And, you know, I was an immigrant. My teeth were not in the best condition. You know, there were things, there were real things that were a separating factor. And I knew also that, like, you can't really talk very much in bars. And my thing was always going to be talking. And so, like, I knew that I didn't ever want to be that person who was like, oh, no, that's not for me. Because that meant rejecting queerness, because that was the most public, recognizable face of queerness. But I also knew that really wasn't ever going to be the place where I felt at my best and most proudly, fabulously gay.
Brandon, what about you?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, just here in D.C., which was probably one of only two cities where I've been, like, out, since I've been out, where I've actually sort of, like, been involved in different queer communities. And, you know, when I think, I don't know if I would consider myself a part of, like, the bar scene, even though I always enjoy going, just because it's like whenever a queer friend is visiting from out of town or something, we will hit up all the sort of like popular gay spots, and I always enjoy going. And I think the reason I don't go more often is more like a money issue. I'm just like, I can easily spend a lot on these 2-for-1 cocktails at number 9 in a way that's like probably not great. But I do, June, what you're saying about being self-conscious, though, that resonates with me for slightly different reasons. I think about how, you know, if somebody had to conjure up sort of the scene in DC, I would say it's, you know, it's mostly white. It is mostly well-adjusted people. They might be sort of bourgeois. And I think there's a lot of, you know, to an extent, it might be my own sort of paranoia, but I think there's always a sort of expectation that, like, you might be sort of gawked at in a way, or, you know, just like you're having attention brought to yourself that you don't necessarily want. And so those are things that I think about when I go to some of the, I guess, like, more popular DC bars with that particular scene. At the same time, like, again, like, it doesn't dissuade me from going. It's just something where, like, I kind of have to have the right mindset and be in the mood to go.
This conversation is really a little bit of a privilege check for me as a white gay man, I think, because I experience the question of the scene as, like, I've always thought of myself as someone that can, like, move between, like, most scenes or any scenes. I mean, I think that's been true. And I mean, I just talked about going to the Black Party, right? And I feel like most other gay sub scenes, or at least gay, you know, ones that are centered around gay men anyway, are pretty easy for me to drop in and out of. And I take a lot of pleasure in that, actually. And it actually irks me a little bit when people are dismissive of some of those scenes so quickly. But listening to this conversation, I, like, understand why. Like, you know, it's because you've had those experiences. But I also do think that there can be like a lumping together of everyone that enjoys a certain kind of, you know, say, mm-hmm. like, I don't know, like a... let's say circuit parties, right? Which is not something that I do a lot, but, like, I think that is a kind of scene that people look at and dismiss. But there's a lot of beauty there. And I mean that in the sense, not like physical beauty, but just like the beauty of queer people celebrating together and dancing and doing something that I still think is actually quite fragile, and that we haven't been able to do for that long.
Yeah.
And so when people are sort of like, ew, the scene, like, that mm-hmm. upsets me because they're not seeing that part of it. But at the same time, there's like all this exclusion that's happening too, for other reasons. And so, I'm just thinking a lot about like the ease with which I can kind of move between scenes and how that might not be true for other people.
It also, I've been thinking about how queer women's spaces
there's like less room for scene segregation in queer women's spaces, I think, because there are few and far between. There, you know, businesses or parties or events that cater primarily to queer women or trans people are like not, they're like even fewer and further between than those that cater primarily towards gay men. So it feels like in some ways there are the sub scenes are a little bit less developed or less robust, especially in communities with smaller queer populations. And in DC, one of the bigger like subcultures, not just of queer people, but of people, is the punk and DIY scene. Mm-hmm. And I consider myself sort of halfway a part of that scene. And it's one of the few scenes I've been a part of where queer and straight people share space and share political concerns and worldviews pretty seamlessly.
Huh. Well, that really makes me wonder about something that I would say when I was a youth and searching for my scene in DC in the 80s, it felt to me that one of the most key divisions, and it was a division between queer people, was political and non-political. Because and partly that was like a proxy for other things, but there was this sense that, oh, politics boring, oh no, like you go to that other group for that, you go somewhere else, like we're not talking about politics here, we're dancing. Has that changed, or did I just have a bad experience? I suppose you can't answer that second
changed.
Part.
I think it's definitely changed. I mean, even like the whatever lesbian sports bar whose logo is like a softball pitcher with a long ponytail that's rainbow colored is extremely political. At least as far as I can perceive and know.
I also feel like what political and queer life means changed in a way that made that more possible since the 80s. Like, I'm thinking about you could be political in the last 10 years and just support marriage equality, which is not such a radical thing to support necessarily, but is pretty easy for anybody to sign on to. Whereas, you know, in the 80s, it would have been bigger asks probably.
And I guess too, that you no longer, like there are other ways of meeting partners. So the bar, like it's okay for bars or dance scenes to be about just like group activities and group connection and transcendence of that kind, rather than meeting Mr. or Mrs. Wright and, moving on from there. So you can kind of, you don't have to, it feels like not as much pressure as well in those, in those spaces.
Well, I also thought about this in terms of a scene that I like to think I'm a member of, the Zaddy scene. And well, partly because, you know, I was talking to somebody about this the other day and about how, you know, what's the difference between like daddy and Zaddy? And, you know, daddy is something that has like very, like much clearer queer history to it, especially with like leather daddies and stuff like that. Whereas like Zaddy seems to sort of like to originate from straight culture. But I think, you know, the definition of a zaddy that I like to adhere to, I think is broad enough and vague enough that it allows queer people to very, very, very easily queer the shit out of it and sort of smuggle that into their own, you know, different queer scenes. So like if you think about men who are considered zaddies.
What is your working definition of a zaddy?
So my working definition is actually one that I took from Clover Hope, who wrote this for Jezebel back in 2017. And she says, zaddy is a guy you look at and think, zam, zaddy. Immediately, you know in your heart who's not a zaddy. It's an instinctual response that's not worth explaining in depth because you're supposed to just feel it. Super broad, super vague. In a way that it's easy to, like, for queer people to appropriate certain, like, that lexicon.
It's like a little bit of a tautological definition where you're like, or almost like a you know it when you see it kind of a thing that I think that's inherently queer in my opinion.
And especially because I think when you think of sort of celebrities in particular who are considered zaddies. A lot of them are straight dudes, right? So like the Dark Lord and Sabrina, Colin Firth, Drake.
Wait, how are all those people in the same category?
You have to feel it.
I have very different sexual reactions to all of them.
Yeah,
people.
Me too.
Really? Idris Elba, my former landlord. but like, you know, a lot of, I think, younger gays in particular sort of latch onto these people in ways that I think, in, you know, when you think about it, you're sort of querying sort of straight norms of masculinity in a way that I think is actually really fun. You know, even I think to an extent it's sort of performative, but I think there is something there that is very queer and that is very interesting.
I want to know what you guys think about this working theory that I have, which is that in some ways the gay scene and also all of these you know, subdivisions of queer scenes that we've been talking about are in some can be shaped by or formed in reaction to or in conversation with straight people's stereotypes and expectations of queer people.
I definitely think that this 80s situation that I am vaguely recalling was definitely informed by that, because I think a lot of the appearance policing was actually around, you know, let's not be the ugly men-like trolley creatures that straight people say we are or used to. I don't think they still do. But like, I think that instead of like recognizing and celebrating the, you know, the various expressions of queerness at that time, at least, we were really into policing, like, could you just maybe put on some makeup? Could you take better care of yourself? Do you have to dress like that? And I think that, you know, it's clear that that has changed. I mean, like, we're so much more open about expression and certainly around trans stuff and about, you know, about gender presentation.
Yeah, June, that actually makes me think of something. And Christina, you kind of pointed to this in your introduction, that there are people who identify as sort of non-scene and like, is that a scene in itself? I mean, what do y'all think about that? I feel like it is sort of, it's funny that like as much as some of us try to like differentiate ourselves from these things, we can't help but like form them over again. And I feel like you see, like, especially among, for example, gay men, and like, and you see it on Grindr a lot, like people being like non-scene, don't like the scene. Like, what is that? I mean, Brandon, do you have any thoughts about like what that means? Like, what are those guys signaling and what is their scene about?
Yeah. So, you know, I try not to diagnose people as
self-hating
homophobes. But I mean, I do think like to an extent, like, I wonder where that's coming from and what it's actually trying to project. Because to me, I'm just like, okay, like if, you know, the quote unquote scene isn't your thing, then why is that something that you feel the need to tell people?
Broadcast.
And then what is your, like, what do you like?
Right.
You
like, know? I'm more interested in knowing that than just knowing that, like, because to me, it almost seems like a sort of, you know, you're sending some sort of like value statement about like, I'm better than that or, you know, I don't know. Like, I feel like it's unnecessary.
More serious.
Right. And the fact that, like, you try to make it something that's necessary to me seems, like, problematic. So that's generally how I read people who are kind of like, oh, like, that's, like, almost, like, to me, I almost think they're saying, like, oh, that's, like, too gay. Which I'm just like, oh, that seems like an unnecessary way to, like, talk about anyone. Like, why can't these things coexist? Why can't you like what you like and let people who do like those sorts of spaces enjoy those sorts of spaces without, like, your judgment?
Yeah.
I just want us all to like be able to hold hands and acknowledge that we all live in like many different scenes and like that's cool. And if like you don't like, you know, the bars or whatever, don't go to the bars.
Right.
Awesome. The person who does like the bars probably also likes three other things that maybe you do like. You know, I go to these dance parties. I also am like a dinner party queen, like come to my dinner party, you know, like there are all kinds of scenes that we can be part of and we can move between them. And that's like the beauty of human existence and blah, blah, blah. So I don't know.
Seems like a good ending note to strike for this.
Yeah. I feel like maybe that's where we should leave it.
Please everybody join me in a chorus of Kumbaya.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
All right. So as our listeners may be aware, there is a millennial person with rolled up sleeves running for the Democratic presidential nomination. He is called Mayor Pete. He is, like us, a gay. He is, in fact, only the second openly gay person to run for a major party's ticket following the GOP's Fred Karger in 2012. And he is the first to have a serious chance at the nomination, at least based on early buzz and fundraising. All of this has generated some fascinating and at times heated discussion over the past few weeks as queer people across the country process their feelings about this man being held up as a sign of progress for our community. We're going to try to add to that discussion today.
You sound like the leader of, you know, a mediation group or something. I so appreciate you, Brian.
So honestly, though, no, this like discourse has gotten like so spicy that I feel like we actually do need some of that like mediation, like ground rules, yeah. Like don't yuck my yum and whatever. But I think maybe we should agree on one thing like in this conversation. We're not here today asking whether Pete Buttigieg is gay enough
quote,
by some
unquote.
Arbitrary measure, gay enough, quote, quote, or like the right kind of gay, right? Like we don't care who he likes on Drag Race. We don't care if he knows what Drag Race is. That's not the question. What we're considering is this larger question of what kind of connection we expect or even want like our queer leaders to have to queer politics or communities, especially when they sort of rocket to the national stage like this. So does everyone agree to those ground rules? Does that
yes.
feel good?
We agree.
Consent. Awesome. So, Christina, I understand that you might have some thoughts on this.
Huh.
Would you like to weigh in?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I would. That was a slightly rude way of introducing it, but thank you, Brian. No. So, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote a piece for Slate.com about Pete Buttigieg that made waves. I would say it made a lot of people angry. I've never experienced, you know, I write about like abortion, sexual assault, constantly engaging in what I like to think is incisive cultural and political criticism. And I've never experienced the kind of feedback that I got from gay men that as when I wrote about Pete Buttigieg. So the gist of my piece, I had heard from straight and queer people alike that people were sort of struggling with the idea of how to interpret Pete Buttigieg as a candidate in terms of diversity and representation in the Democratic 2020 presidential slate, which is mm-hmm. the most diverse ever. It's kind of crazy to think about for me anyway. But Pete Buttigieg kind of pulled in front of a lot of these other people who have a lot more name recognition and at the time had a lot more money than he did. So I was trying to pull apart how his different identities, not just his gay identity, has affected his life experience and the way people perceive him as a candidate. And my thesis was basically that we can't discount his other identities besides his gay identity. And if you take him at his word, and he's talked a fair amount about being gay, he doesn't really think his gay identity has had much bearing on who he is as a person. So I think it touched a raw nerve for a lot of people who are genuinely ecstatic to see a gay man who, you know, has a husband and is not trying to hide his gay identity at all, being so feted by a lot of really sort of establishment politicians and being taken seriously. And, mm-hmm. it, you know, he'll be in the debates. Like, this will be a really impressive platform for a gay politician to have. And, you know, he is pretty progressive. So that's exciting, too. He's not somebody who's trying to be like the conservative foil or the person who's trying to justify some shitty policies because they're gay. So like you can kind of trust me or feel good about voting for bad policies or non-progressive policies because, look, I'm gay. He's made a lot of people really excited.
Yeah. And I think actually, to sort of zoom out from him a little bit and think about this larger question of like, what do we want from someone like him? And, you know, if it was another person, I think we could ask the same kind of questions. Like, do we want our leaders or political leaders or other leaders to be excited about being queer? I mean, you just spoke about how he seems to be at best kind of like fine with it, but not, you know, it's not something that he thinks of as being super influential in his self-formation, for example. I mean, when y'all are like looking at who you want to personally be excited about when they get into these kinds of positions, what do you want from them in terms of their sort of emotional relationship to their identity?
Well, the first thing I thought about with, you know, sort of specifically the word excited was sort of like, okay, what does that mean in this context and what can it mean in this context? And so, you know, I don't, you know, necessarily need a gay politician to be like, you know, bouncy like an electron or something when they're talking about sort of their gay identity or whatever. But like, it does matter that if like, is your being queer something that energizes and meaningfully influences, you know, not only the types of policies that you kind of stand for, but also your ability, your openness to listening to constituents, to voters, to citizens who might be affected by these issues, by this identity in a way that like you might not be. And I think that's just, I feel like that's kind of a low bar. It's just like, do you have empathy for people who don't have your exact experience of queerness? Do you know how to address that? And are you willing to address it so that that's not a glaring blind spot when it comes to pushing for certain things? To me, that's pretty basic but very important.
I feel like for anyone who is in this position of being like the first gay candidate, and I myself am like a gay voter, like looking at it, if that is going to be meaningful to, if the gay part of that description is going to be meaningful to me, it has to be meaningful to them, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in this particular case, it just doesn't feel like it is super meaningful to him. It feels like something, in fact, that he had to get over and as a sort of on his path to this candidacy, and that he's integrated it now into his life, of course, but that it wasn't something that was like sort of a source of joy historically. And my queerness is that for me. And so to not hear people, not to hear a person in this position speak that way makes it hard for me to be excited or to like relate to them on an emotional level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, and you know, there's nothing wrong with somebody having the sort of relationship to their gayness or queerness that Pete has to his. But I think it's different to say, like, there's nothing wrong with that, but it also doesn't have to resonate with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I don't expect a candidate for president to be like a punk dyke, you know? But I don't see a lot of overlap in our relationships with queerness. I'm not saying he's not gay or that I'm more gay than him or less gay than him. And I think that's a place where this discourse can kind of get derailed. There's some people who, you know, embrace queer community and queerness as a political worldview. And then other people who are like, you know, this is one part of me mm-hmm. that is like, I just happen to love these other people. Pete has said it's just like me having brown hair. That's what he said in his coming out essay. You know, mm-hmm. he's sort of like, I'm like you straight people, except I'm gay.
And that the decision for me to be gay was like above my pay grade, right? Like as a reference to God, you know, born this way, like.
Actually, yeah. I kind of think he does find joy in his queerness, but the way he frames it is in almost exclusively religious terms. So just like said, Brian, he has said, like, you know, he said to Mike Pence wasn't there, but he said, you know, addressing him when he wasn't in the room, like, if you have a problem with mm-hmm. me, you take that up with God because God created me this way. And then he's also said on several occasions that his marriage has brought him closer to God, his marriage to a man.
That's true.
So like, yes, I think he does. He is, I think, now happy that he's gay, even though he has said that, you know, previously he would have taken a pill to be straight if he could have. He would have taken a knife and cut out the part of him that was gay. I think it seems like he's over that.
You know,
but the, like, I don't think that my queerness brings me further or closer to any God. And so I think his identity as a man of faith might be more, might have more resonance mm-hmm. with, you know, people of faith than his queerness relates to my queerness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, mm-hmm. it just seems like it's more salient.
Yeah.
I think that's a really great point, Christina. I want to change gears slightly and look at, you know, this idea of like a connection to queer politics. So, you know, he is the first or second major candidate for this particular office. But, you know, there have been decades and decades of queer politics that one might look to as inspiration. And it doesn't seem like that, you know, Pete does. So let me just read a quote, actually, from this great New York Magazine profile that just went up recently by Olivia Nuzzi. And it's sort of about this. So it says, after he returned in 2015 to being mayor of South Bend, he made the decision to publicly come out at the age of 33, 5 months before voters took to the polls to decide whether to reject him. Quote, the first time I knew that you could be gay and still be in politics, I guess, was when I became aware of Barney Frank, who's also just a remarkable mind and a very interesting person to watch, Buttigieg told me. I was vaguely aware of Harvey Milk and have come to understand more and more of his significance. But there were not a lot of gay political role models that I could look to, certainly in my own geography, when I was getting started. End quote. So that's a really interesting statement to me because it takes like queer political role models in a very, very narrow sense, I think, right? Like it's Barney Frank, Harvey Milk, and like that's kind of it. And that like gives me pause. Like I'll just speak personally because, as I say, there are, you know, decades of political activism from the queer community that you could look to as inspiration. Certainly not on the presidential scale because like homophobia, right? Like we couldn't do it. But certainly in terms of values and in terms of what the community wanted or needed at, you know, at specific points in history. And you could imagine like a person, a candidate in this position coming out of that, right? No, maybe not being like the radical punk anarchist that some might want, but like at least coming out of that tradition and having that sort of inform the way that they talk about things. And this particular person doesn't, but it would be possible. And so I don't know, what does that quote like sort of say to you guys? Do you crave something more like that, or how does that land?
When I read that quote, I immediately thought of Tammy Baldwin because you know, I tried to narrow my vision of the type of what I think the type of gay politician that I think Pete Buttigieg was probably looking for, which is like palatable to straight people, like on their way to higher office, ready to, you know, be accepted as a sort of mainstream political figure, kind of a queer, not somebody out of the activist tradition. I don't think that's mm-hmm. I don't think he's an activist. You know, you look at some other politicians, if we don't want to talk about scenes, people have been comparing him to Obama. You know, Obama came out of community organizing. Pete Buttigieg came out of the military and McKinsey. That's a totally different scene and a totally different vision of power, I think. Again, no value judgment. You know, everyone has their own political opinions on whether that matters and what that signifies. But I don't think he would I don't expect him to pick up on, you know, some of the activists or even necessarily the great queer orators that he might take inspiration from. But Tammy Baldwin is somebody that I was kind of sad that he didn't think of because he's saying, you know, especially in the Midwest, or what did he say? Certainly in my own geography. Tammy Baldwin's in Wisconsin. When he was coming of age, she was the first openly gay woman elected to the U.S. Congress. That was in 1998. In 2012, you know, before he came out, 3 years before Pete Buttigieg came out publicly, she became the first openly gay person elected to the U.S. Senate. She was, you know, serving in state legislature before that. Like, it kind of, I was like, do you not see women as a role model? Or like, were you looking hard? You know, especially as a queer woman, I really look up to a lot of these queer women who have paved the way in politics. And sometimes I don't think they get enough credit for the groundbreaking that they've done.
Yeah, like one thing that kind of jumps out to me is, you know, I think, you know, this isn't not all queer people are like this, but I think queer history as something that is withheld from us for so long that I think that often when people come out, one of the first things you try to do is like to learn more about this history. And then I think, you know, when you scratch just below the surface, like it's so rich. And so like for me, when I think of like queer political role models, I think of people like Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, Lorraine Hansberry, people who are more in the sort of activist tradition. But like you can even look at just like how robust queer organizing has been since World War II, right? Like you have the Mettersheim Society, you have Daughters of Bilitis, you had ACT UP. And so like, you know, it's not, you're not running for president, but these are people and organizations that have significantly influenced queer politics. And so to me, that just is, it sort of shows like how I think there's work to be done when it comes to like, you know, learning about your history and learning, like it's not even just so you can just say like, oh, like I know about so-and-so, but you know, it, how can you expect to necessarily build on the work that's already been done if you don't know about it?
You know, one thing that I've seen a lot of people saying about Pete is that him being on this stage is like life, it will be life-changing for queer kids. And it makes me wonder, like, should we all just sort of at some point put these discussions aside and get behind this guy because he is one of us? And would we do that for, you know, should we do that for any figure like this? What do you guys think about that?
Well, partly I think like at what point in, I guess, the road to the White House, would we be putting things aside? Like, you know, if it comes to like, you know, if he is the Democratic nominee, that's like one thing versus important conversations, like you're saying, Christina, that we have not had, but that are very, very important. And you can have respectful, rigorous conversations mulling over what somebody means to certain people, to certain parties. And, you know, I don't think that means that you have to vote for Buttigieg.
I also think we have a long overdue luxury right now, which is to, you know, not try to choose one identity over another. I mean, there are so many candidates running who would mark a major first or a step forward in terms of representation. And I'm glad that they're all going to be up there debating and, you know, some giving us new things to argue about, especially in terms of policy and degrees of progressiveness and their strategies for overcoming Trump in the general election. That, like, I find it impossible to choose one thing that's important to me, which is queer identity and representation, over any other. What do you think, Brian? You're the one who posed the question.
I agree with you both. I love what you've been saying, Christina, about this. We are sort of in one way to look at this, even though it's like a heated discourse, it's like such a privilege to get to have it. And so I'm down to have it for a while yet. And then I think once there is a Democratic nominee, that's who I will be voting for because like I have to. But until then, I think the conversation is great. And, you know, queer people deserve to be able to have this discussion. And I hope we can let each other have it, like maybe in a more, I don't know, you know, I'm not going to say civil way, but like in a more understanding way, than has been happening, as we move forward with the Buttigieg, moment that we're in.
I found this really healing. Thank you guys.
Good.
I'd also be really interested in hearing from any listeners in Indiana, if y'all are out there, about, you know, what the gay download is on Pete Buttigieg in Indiana. What scene is he a part of? Is he a part
Maybe
of
he is a scene queen and we just don't know. Like, that's like
that's if, totally yeah, a possibility.
Send us an email if that's the truth, because that would be amazing.
It's like yeah. Silky Nutmeg.
We're at outwardpodcast@slate.com if you have any intel.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
So one part of the LGBTQ umbrella that, when it's not being overlooked entirely, is too often misunderstood is bisexuality. To talk with us more about her own experiences with bi culture and how that fits into broader queer scenes, we have Shirley Chan, former Slate video producer and current HuffPost video director. Shirley, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So happy to have you.
So could you start by telling us how you identify and what city you live in?
I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I identify as bisexual.
And what traditionally, I guess, has been your experience as a bi person navigating queer spaces in New York City or elsewhere?
I usually just identify with the umbrella term queer because I feel as though there's a lot of biphobia in queer spaces still, to where it's something that I don't reveal until later on when I've established a relationship with someone.
And could you describe like what that biphobia sort of looks like? What forms does it take?
So I've dated a lot of women where they don't know that I'm bisexual until one day I mentioned that I think like a man is attractive, and then I mentioned, oh yeah, like I'm bisexual, and then they're really taken back and just like, wait, you're bi? And it's just a lot of kind of like, it feels like they lose trust in me all of a sudden because of just like, you know, stereotypes that come with being bi, of just like, oh, like I'm very promiscuous, like I'm gonna leave them for a man. And it's weird because, you know, the stereotypes still stick, and I feel like I've experienced that with a lot of dating a lot of lesbians.
Wow. Yeah. Sort of like always, I guess, making the case for like, are you actually queer and are you going to stick around, which is kind of wild.
Yeah.
So the theme of this particular episode is the scene. So we're looking at the queer cultural environment broadly, but also the different subcultures within it. So in your own experience, is there a particular bi scene or even spaces or groups that seem to more explicitly embrace bi people in their own sort of unique experiences?
So I don't think that there's necessarily a bi scene, because I often just find myself in a lot of queer spaces. However, I find that, like, I tend to go to parties or events that are advertised or marketed as like a queer space rather than just like a lesbian party, because I think I associate a lot of like a lot of my biphobic experiences have been with people who with women who strongly identify as lesbians. And so I find myself going to queer spaces more because people are more accepting overall. And that is where I feel more comfortable coming out as bi, even though I also just identify as queer before I reveal that I'm bi.
If you had to describe a bi culture, not just queer culture, but if there's a culture specific to bi people, would you say that there are like specific cultural or political or social touchstones?
I mean, so for me, like finding bi culture, I find it mostly on the internet. Like I have friends who are also bi and, you know, like they're my support system in real life. But I think I find a lot of it on the internet through like memes and Twitter, and a lot of people who I feel like I follow a lot of people on Twitter who are very outspoken about being bi. And I feel like I try to also be vocal about it on the internet more so than in person. And I think it's because I feel like I have the support of the bi people out there, to where I'm making these jokes and like it's like when like a new movie comes out and both of the leads, like the man and the woman, is super hot, then I'm like, that's bi culture right there. You know, like
nice.
I read a really good article in Auto Straddle that came out in conjunction with the final episode of Broad City, and it talked about the idea that these two women who, you know, the two Broad City leads who are both queer in real life and are both queer on the show. And I'm not sure exactly how they identify, but they both hook up with women and men on the show. So they might identify as bi. But the article talked about how the show, for some people, really elevated the idea that there could be a bi culture separate from like just bi people, you know, taking bits and pieces from straight culture or lesbian culture or gay culture and making their own mishmash of it. But the idea that there's mm-hmm. actually, you know, the possibility for and maybe in some communities, the actual existence of, you know, by like way of dressing and by jokes and like by ways of interacting with the world. Is that something that rings true to you at all?
That sounds like a very interesting article.
You should read it. Or is that something that you would aspire to as a member of the bi community?
I mean, yeah, I would definitely aspire to that. But I was telling Daniel about this the other day, but I just like can't imagine what a bi culture would look like. I mean, what you mentioned about, you know, taking little pieces of just like lesbian culture and little pieces of like straight culture. Does it have to be that way? Or can it just be just like a melting pot of like, I mean, then like, I feel like that's also just me trying to identify closer with the queer part of my identity. Yeah. Like the first thing that I, you know, come out with. And I'm not sure, you know, like, do I want, like, the melting pot to be bi culture? But then it's just like, or do I want, like, the little pieces of being a lesbian and being straight? Like, I'm not sure what I want. And I'm not sure what bi culture would look like. And I'm not sure what, a bi space would look like. Like, would I be there with only... It's not like I would be there with only just, like, other bi people. Like, you know? I don't know.
I also think it's worth... maybe turning that question around slightly and recognizing that like bi people have created things that we call gay culture or lesbian culture, but they haven't been credited with it for like decades or centuries, depending on how you want to look at it.
Or they've often been just sort of flattened as gay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I, yeah, exactly. So either they've been like sort of misnamed by like history, or they were had to be closeted about it because of all the phobia.
Mm-hmm.
So I think sometimes when we make these divisions between like what's gay culture or straight culture, like actually bi people have been there all along making both of those things. And so I think it's worth like reframing the question that way a little bit too, and just acknowledging the presence and contributions.
Yeah, I feel like oftentimes, you know, if a bi person were to do anything that isn't heterosexual, it counts for, you know, gay culture, but it's not credited as like, you know, like a bi person did it. Yeah, exactly.
I also wonder if some of those distinctions are beginning to be erased, hopefully in a way that doesn't erase the existence of bi people. But the way you talk about queer spaces, Shirley, is also the way I experience queer spaces. You know, I identify as queer and a lesbian, but like queer first and foremost, in part because of my own, you know, history and relationships and community with trans and non-binary people and also cis men. But like, it's not, it doesn't feel so much like there's a strong division between, or that when you talk about queer spaces, the idea hopefully would be that everybody who identifies as LGBTQ would, you know, feel at home in that space, and that creates its own sort of culture. Whereas I think, you know, in previous generations and maybe still in certain spaces, there's been more of a stark division where people assume, for instance, that anyone who goes to a specific party or community gathering is like just a lesbian or, you know, in other spaces, people are just straight.
I've even like had that interaction, like that thought within the past like a few days where it's like I'll tweet something that's gay and then somebody was just like, oh, I thought this person was straight. And they'll comment on a way that's just like, totally down or something like that, and I'm just like gay when it's like maybe they're bi, like maybe they identify in some other way, but just how easily, like, you know, even, you know, I like to think of us as thoughtful queer people, like how easy it is to sort of oversimplify people's contributions and experiences in that way. But
I mean, a lot of times when I'm like joking with friends, like if I'm dressed like more butch than usual, it's just like, Shirley, you look so gay. And I just like, I accept that, you know, like I'm not going to expect anyone to be like, oh, that's so bi of you. You know, like that's something I would never expect to hear from anybody. But, you know, like I'm like, okay, yeah, I look gay.
But is that, do you take it a little bit as like a affront to your bi identity?
No, I don't. I think, I mean, then it's just kind of like fun. And then I'm like thinking of gay as just like a more like general, I guess, then that's just me just like thinking like yay is just synonymous with butch in that context, or you know, like I'm looking gayer than usual, okay, I'm just looking more butch.
You wrote a really good piece for Slate that made me lol. It was, I think the headline was something like, everything Kristen Stewart does. Like, I get gayer every time Kristen Stewart does a new movie. Like,
honestly, now it's so true. Kristen Stewart just gets gayer and gayer. And I'm
and
like,
so
wait,
you.
Same. Like, our gayness, like, parallels each other.
Oh, she's so fucking good. I was actually
and
hoping...
the new the photos from the Charlie's Angel, like,
words
like,
right out of my mouth.
Are you kidding me?
I needed to have a moment to bring that up in this episode. Fucking
those
Google
arms.
It. Listeners,
those arms.
If you haven't seen it already, Google it. She's incredible. But yeah, like your use of the word, I would be lying if I said your use of the word gayer in that piece didn't make me think like, well, wait, but isn't Shirley bi? You know?
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm still sort of confronting that in myself, that like there clearly is like a stereotypical gay culture that people associate, you know, women's like the way they dress and the way they talk about women and stuff with. But like, so it I feel like it's easy to describe someone as gay, getting like gayer or less gay. And, you know, everyone can sort of laugh about it and we can all kind of accept that. But it definitely crossed my mind. Like, do you feel like that there would be a point where, you know, like gender and sexuality in some communities are just so fluid that it makes no sense anymore to say like so-and-so looks gayer or is getting gayer?
I think regardless of how fluid the community becomes, I think, you know, using the term like more gay, like gayer or less gay or whatnot will still always be there, because I see it as, so, you know, if it's like two women talking to each other, I see it that, you know, when a woman is more butch, saying like gayer makes sense. And then, you know, if like a gay man is being more femme in a way and being, you know, just really flamboyant, like that's also just like gayer. And I think I see that term as just like straying from the norm, or like what people think
and
is
like the
norm,
gendered
norm. Yeah.
And I think part of it is like reclaiming power in something that power and pride in something that has traditionally been, you know, marginalized in society, like, you know, people being punished for gender nonconformity.
Yeah. Like anything that challenges, you know, the gender norm or any sort of norm. And like for someone who is even, you know, someone who's even just like non-binary, like if they're wearing something where it's just so completely just like neutral, like that is their way of challenging the norm as well, you know, to where people can't say they look feminine or masculine. Right. They just like, they've created something in their, like on their own. I guess in a way, would that also be gayer?
Or would it be bi culture?
Buyer, yeah.
Buyer.
One thing I guess I would like to hear more from you, Shirley, about is, do you find a sense of community with other bi people that is missing from the community that you find with other, you know, gay people or straight people? Is there a specific value in you know, that sort of we all understand each other type of community?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a value, because a lot of times, you know, with biphobia, a lot of like what you feel and how you identify feels a little invalidated. But with surrounding myself with bi people, you know, being able to, like I was saying earlier, you know, a lot of these jokes that go back to just like basically pointing out like, hey, like bi people are still here, you're erasing us. But in that way, just our, like, it's like our way of maintaining our own culture. And yeah, it's great, because I mean, I surround myself with other friends who are bi, and I feel more connected with them because I don't feel invalidated if I say a man is cute or something,
right,
or I say I slept with a man. And that's a good feeling, just like the same way of like when I was coming out to my friends and I would tell them that I like a woman, and they were happy for me. You know, it's mm-hmm. the same thing of just like this, like when I tell my other bi friends that I slept with a man, they're like, ooh, how was it? Instead of just
and
like,
not just
what?
Like surprise. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. It's, yeah.
No, that's great.
It's always worth noting, too, that studies show that the majority of the LGBT community is bi, actually. So,
oh, wow.
You look into it. So, wow. It's you shouldn't have to feel that way. There's more of you than everybody else.
Thank you.
Well, Shirley, thanks so much for coming on the show. I think you've enriched our own queer experiences and the show by speaking with us.
So glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right, that's just about it for this month's episode. But first, I want to hear y'all's gay agendas. What do you have to recommend for us, Brandon?
So I saw William Friedkin's 1970 adaptation of Boys in the Band.
And you haven't stopped talking about it since.
I really haven't. I've been bugging you on Slack, on our phone calls. And I was just so tremendously moved by it and was kind of ashamed. Because I was like, how did this movie come out in 1970 based on a play that came out a couple years before? How's it been around this long and I hadn't heard of it?
Wait, you hadn't heard of it or you hadn't seen it?
I hadn't heard of it.
Wow.
I hadn't even heard of it.
I still haven't seen it, but I've definitely heard of it.
I was with a friend in Rock Hill when I was going to the Hideaway, Brian.
Yes.
And he mentioned it and his mouth literally dropped when I said, I don't know what you're talking about. But, you know, put simply, you know, it follows a group of friends in New York who come together one night to celebrate one of the friends, Harold's birthday. And so the scene, it's New York, 1970. You know, they're younger. I think they're supposed to be younger than they actually are.
Shade.
In the movie. Well, because I think somebody was just like, I'm 29. And I was like, girl. So, you know, it's this pretty somewhat diverse group, but sort of like the sort of hodgepodge of queers you'd expect to find, I guess, in like New York in 1970. And, you know, they seem like they're, you know, sort of well-established, well-adjusted to their own identities. But of course, that's part of the twist is that they're not. And so I'm aware that the main criticism of the film is that it, you know, sort of depicts gay men as being both self-hating and narcissists. And, you know, they're just going to, because they're not going to kill, you know, they're not going to kill themselves, but they are going to have these awful, unhappy lives. And so there's a part of a speech that I'm just going to read that's very short. Brian, I'm sure you know which one is coming. So Harold gives this to Michael, who's hosting the party toward the end of the movie. And it's one of the most cutting things I've ever heard in my life. So he says, you're a homosexual and you don't want to be, but there's nothing that you can do to change it. Not all your prayers to your God, not all the analysis you can buy and all the years you've got left to live. You may very well one day be able to know a heterosexual life if you want it desperately enough, if you pursue it with all the fervor with which you annihilate, but you will always be a homosexual as well. Always, Michael, always, until the day you die. All the while, Michael is turned toward like the balcony and his face is just like contorting as he's being read.
I feel like I want that read at my wedding.
It was well, and then Harold, when he's like leaving, he turns around and he's like, call you tomorrow. But, you know, like on the one hand, it does get at the point about like, you know, gay men are trying to like somehow compensate for the fact that they are gay. But also I like how it does speak to something on some level, how it's a very, it's natural to be gay, how like if that is how you identify and how you live, you can't escape it no matter how much you try. And I feel like that in some ways is freeing and sort of takes a burden off your shoulders, like whew, like this isn't necessarily a choice. I also think it's important to acknowledge that this is still an internal struggle that a lot of people have, just because of how they're socialized and the images and the messages that they're receiving. Even for this group of gay men in New York, right? Like in a progressive city, this is something that they're all still struggling with. And so I think to have these two declarations, especially when it did it, was nothing short of revolutionary. So check it out.
For my agenda item, I'm going to recommend a demo tape from a DC queer punk band. The band is called Homo Superior. The drummer is also Booby Traps drummer. Her name's Kit. What's up, Kit? She's so great. I feel like they are a really great example of what I love about queer punk and specifically DC's queer punk scene. It's like really in your face, but also kind of tongue-in-cheek queerness. The Pete Buttigieg's, my gayness brings me closer to God will not find much to love about this. It's extremely sacrilegious, but in a way that I love. The band is fronted by Donna Slash, who also does a lot of drag in DC. Brian, I think you've seen her perform at Gay Bash.
Yes. Oh my gosh. She's so good. Yeah.
Sort of like in the bearded queen tradition like 80s, like hair band slut sort of aesthetic.
So good.
One of the tracks on the demo is called Rail Mary, which I appreciate as a sacrilege and also a pun lover. So go on Bandcamp or wherever you listen to your music, find Homo Superior's Mall Madness demo, give it a listen, let me know what you think. It's really, really short, also demonstrative of the punk aesthetic. So it doesn't take too long to listen, but it's one of my favorite queer scenes, and I highly recommend it.
That is wonderful. Well, changing gears completely, and apropos of my gay dinner party scene, which I'm a part.
I would say you're probably the leader of that scene, Brian.
I'm the leader of it. Apropos of the gay dinner party scene, of which I'm the leader, I wanted to recommend a book from a couple years ago. It was called Provence 1970, and it's written by Luc Barre. And it's a sort of like, I guess you'd call it like a novelized look at a bunch of food world figures in the late 60s and 1970s specifically, including Julia and Paul Child, James Beard, Richard Olney, MFK Fisher, all of whom were in Provence sort of over this, I think it's like a 6-month period, something like that. And it's a queer scene because actually a lot of these folks were queer. That's not like talked about a lot, but MFK Fisher was bisexual. James Beard was gay. Richard Olney was gay. There's a lesbian couple who are lesser known who were also there. Craig Claiborne, the New York Times food critic, was gay. So they were all sort of hanging out together and birthing this like new American French-influenced cuisine that became famous just afterward via like Chez Panisse and restaurants like that. And it's the kind of food that we are all pretty familiar with now, but it sort of started then. And I think you could argue, and the book I think argues this like a bit implicitly, that it is in some ways the output of a little tiny queer scene in France at that moment. And it's also just beautifully written. So highly recommended book to check out, Provence 1970. Wow.
I want to say, I think one of the gayest desserts I've ever had was at your house, Brian. You made some sort of like lavender gelato with like a little cardamom biscotti stuck in it and like the gayest little swirl of lemon zest on top. I don't think I've ever had such like a gay ass dessert in my life.
My gayest kitchen implement is actually the device that makes those little lemon zest swirls.
They're so curly.
It's so great. Cute. No, I'm so flattered that you remembered that. Thank you.
And that's your gay agenda for this month. Please send us feedback, topic ideas, and advice questions at outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook or Twitter at Slate Outward. And also, don't forget to get your tickets to our live shows in June at slate.com/live. Thank you to Danielle Hewitt, who provided production assistance for this episode. Our producer is Daniel Schrader. June Thomas is the senior managing producer of Slate and the scene queen of our dreams. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, and rate and review the show so others can find it. We'll be back in your feeds on May 15th. Bye, Christina.
Bye, Brandon.
Bye, Brian.
See ya.
Stay gay.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.